The OCD Stories is sponsored by NoCD. NoCD are dedicated to creating a better everyday life for people with OCD by making care more accessible, more connected, and more effective. NoCD deliver exposure and response prevention sessions with an OCD-trained therapist directly inside the NoCD platform, done over face-to-face video conferencing. In the US, NoCD now accept insurance from insurance companies including Cigna, United Healthcare, Regents, Premera Blue Cross, and Blue Cross Blue Shield, among many others. NoCD can also help out with out-of-network reimbursement if they currently don't take your insurance. If you want to find out more, call NoCD's intake team to find out if they currently take your insurance in your state. You can do this by going to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or by clicking the link in the episode description. Now onto the episode. Hey guys, and welcome to episode 227 of the OCDstories.com podcast. And this episode, I got on Sam Jones. Sam has kindly agreed to share his story with us, and we go into lots of detail on how OCD has impacted his life and what he's been doing to get better from it. So I originally met Sam a couple of years ago at a Made a Millions event here in the UK. So it's great to finally get him on the podcast to share his story with you. So without further ado, here he is.
On the podcast today, I have Sam Jones, who has kindly agreed to share his story with us. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Thank you, Stuart. Nice to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. And of course, I met you at an OCD event. Geez, what was it, like 2 years ago, maybe?
I think it was, about 18 months.
About 18 months.
Made of Millions launch, yeah.
Yeah, in London, yeah. So it was good to meet you there and hear some of your story. So we're looking forward to hearing more of it now. So as you know, as much detail or as little you want to give, it'd be great to hear your OCD story.
Okay. It all began for me, I think, looking back on it, I think it was sort of, there were some first initial signs that might not have been OCD straight away, but maybe when I go back to when I was about 7 years old, I had, there was probably about a 3 month period just as I got into junior school, and it was this big change at the time for a 7 year old. And I think I had that realization of, you don't live forever, just because I remember being in primary school at the table and this kid opposite me said, you know, you could die today. And it didn't land very well with me. I got very worried about catching like an illness. Mm. And I think looking back on it now, I realize I was going through a emetophobia. That's what evolved out of it. And it got to the point that I actually ended up spending a night in hospital because I was so convinced I was having like appendicitis or something like that. But once I'd had that doctor's opinion the next day, it was almost like, as a 7 year old, a doctor's opinion is finite. Oh yeah, I'm fine. And bang, I got on with my life again. And I thought it was just maybe a little blip in we all have. But then the first real sort of harrowing experience was when I was about 13, in year eight in high school. And I think that's a difficult time anyway when you're going through massive hormonal change.
Yeah.
And there was a catalyst there for Puro, or I know that's not the correct term, but it's easier to, everyone knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I hope anyway, when I say Puro. So that really developed in my second year of high school, and it was overwhelming. You know, it was a terrifying experience. That's not putting it lightly. I'd watched an episode of Frost in the evening, which I don't know why my parents allowed me to stay up with that, but it's basically an episode where speaking to a doctor who's saying that this guy who's committed this crime, he's a paedophile, basically.
Mm.
He's describing how he can't control that. He's just the way he is. And then just a simple thought popped in my head, like, oh my God, what if I could be like that? And it terrified me so much that was a real that was a very difficult time, where also being actually raised as a Roman Catholic by my family, we say at the start of Mass, I have sinned in my thoughts. And I'm my girlfriend would say I take things very literally, which I have to agree with now. And I know that I took that very literally at the time. And I have sinned in my thoughts. So just having an intrusive thought meant, you know, I'm an evil person. I'm a monster, sort of thing. And that was the start of really trying to control my thoughts. And if I had a bad one, I'd have to go and confess it. This idea of confessing, which I used to do to my mum quite a lot. I was very, very lucky in that way, in that my mum just really helped me through it so much at that age. She was very open talking to me about it. I used to do this thing. I know it was a compulsion now, but I used to write it down on paper. If I had an intrusive thought, I could write it down and I could leave it in my mum's bedroom, and then I didn't have to face her face to face to experience that shame that came with it. So that eventually actually got me out of it in some ways, because it was like I started to be able to see things a bit more objectively. By writing it down, it's stuck in my brain, and so yeah, that was a really horrible period, but I did get through it. And I thought I'd beaten it. I was about 16. I thought, I've beaten it. It was a hormonal phase. That's all it was. And then as I got into sixth form, it suddenly, as OCD loves to do, it just completely evolved into something else, which was it sounds ridiculous now, but I had this terrible obsession with worrying about going bald for years and years, 3 or 4 years. That was centered on, you know, if I find one hair that's like maybe a bit finer than the others, is that the start of it? And I think that, it was a really difficult time, because I was trying, obviously I was in sixth form when this started. I still didn't know it was OCD. I thought this was just something else that I had no idea what it was. But that was really difficult. I'm trying to think now what I think, because you're going through all your A levels and your exams and all that pressure. I wanted to get into drama school so badly. And at that age, you're very impressionable. It's the first time you're not wearing uniform. People are trying to express themselves a bit more and feeling where you fit in. And that was, like I said, it sounds quite, I don't know. I look back at it and think, it doesn't sound like anything that should be. And I think that's it, isn't it? With lots of OCD types, they sound on the surface very innocuous. Like that shouldn't, you know, everyone experiences this, that, or the other. But the amount of time and the amount of stress that it took up and it caused was really upsetting. But I managed to get into drama school. I went to Royal Welsh College, which I was really proud of. That was a turbulent couple of years, because I was dealing with that. I remember on the first night of freshers, I was just sitting down in front of the mirror in my halls of residence, just bawling my eyes out, because I'd spent about 3 hours looking at the back of my head and I hadn't gone out and, you know, experienced, you know, what every fresher should be doing, you know, and getting to make new friends. And I spent a long time, the first 2 years of drama school, you're trying to play a character, play these different characters, but you're also trying to be normal as well. And it was like, it was just too much at times. I remember, because you're standing in front of your peers doing a scene, which is quite vulnerable anyway. It's quite a vulnerable experience. It can be, because at that point people are, you know, criticizing and I think trying at the same time not to have a bad thought, as I just said, about my hair, was like, that is going to throw me right off here and I'm just going to break down in front of these people. So that was difficult, but eventually I did settle, and I again did some really good work with that. I got used to the idea. I think I got to about 21 and it just faded, because I was like, oh, if I go bald at 21, loads of my mates are, it's not a big deal. I don't know why I put that age in my, but I did. And that meant 21, it means I'm okay. But I also experienced a very turbulent relationship in college, which was very, very turbulent, distressing. And that was over, and I thought, that's done. I thought, right, I'm doing really well now with my acting. I managed to get an agent. I was really excited about going out into the world and, you know, starting my career. And I knew I'd had all these various experiences that I've explained to you so far, but it was 2 years out of 2 years out of drama school when I got this new relationship, and it was like my whole world turned upside down. This was in 2012, and this was post-traumatic stress from the previous relationship, now inspiring this one. And it was the birth of, you know, what I now know is, well, named, you know, sort of relationship OCD, which is, for me, has been the most difficult subtype to navigate my way through. I think because it impacts on somebody else directly, and that response of, you know, I know a lot of people, those two have this inflated responsibility as well. The fact that it's, you know, it's okay if it's just harming me, but if it's harming somebody else as well, then it's really difficult. And it you know, I think self-esteem takes an absolute battering.
Yeah.
You know? I really, really found that difficult. It gets to the point where it used to get to the point where I couldn't even look at another woman without thinking, oh my God, did I look at her in a flirtatious way? And, you know, everything comes under the microscope. What was that smile? I smiled at her. Oh God, does that mean I like, you know, and have I now been unfaithful? Have I, you know, that means I've cheated. That's paramount to cheating. That was a really difficult time. That was a really difficult time. That's probably the worst period, because I think, also being an actor, I was in a tour of A Midsummer Night's Dream, which is really like, I was playing one of the lovers, one of the big romantic characters who has to tell, you know, Helena how much he's fallen in love with her at the end and kiss her. And I got my, you know, my then girlfriend was in the audience, and I remember the real anguish. It was not enjoyable. You know, it was a horrible experience every night going on, trying to perform a myriad of compulsions just to get me through the scene so that I didn't do anything that I could deem unfaithful. And I could just get off. And it was in front of like hundreds and hundreds of people.
Yeah.
So really stressful that was, and it gets to the point where you just like, well, I just don't want to be an actor anymore. Or you try and find excuses why you shouldn't be an actor. Oh, you know, it's not. Well, actually, there's so many things you could say why you shouldn't be an actor, but you know, it's not a, you know, a stable living or whatever. So you start like convincing yourself that you know, it's not compulsions. I think it's someone said it's acting out of fear disguised as practicality or something.
Yes.
That's what was happening then. During that time, that's when I first sought help. That's when I first went to Mind Charity, which was helpful at the time. But I think I found over the years that after trying probably a million different counselors, it feels like, obviously not, but it feels like that, that unless it's specific specialist OCD therapy, so many of them have just been huge compulsions. Like, I've gone, oh my God, I've actually just gone to this person, and we've just focused on the cognitive part here and nothing else of the CBT or what they're saying they do. And it's more asking questions like, why do you have these thoughts? Well, that's not even important. But that was, so that's taken a long time trying to get that. Sorry, I think I've completely diverted.
It's all good.
So gone off road here. In what I meant to say then was that after that mind therapy, I decided to move to London. Me and my girlfriend had broke up then, and I was ready to go to London. I'd been dying to do this for so long, especially with the acting. I knew it's the epicenter of where it's all at. And and that was a really exciting new chapter. I thought, okay, I've got through this period. My anxiety's gone down. I've been to mind. I'm ready to go to London. At the time, I put down the breakup with my then girlfriend to be, it's just that we weren't meant to be together. It's not relationship OCD. That's the 3 years of stress, but you know, it's fine. But then in 2016, I met my current partner, and again, it was another explosion of ROCD again, and that's when it was like, oh, okay. This happens every single time you meet someone now. This is a running trait. So perhaps I'm starting to think that this is an actual problem. And maybe this counseling isn't right. Maybe I need to find something a bit more specialist. I recall one day when I was in, I think we were in Westfield shopping center together. And I just ended up on the floor because the anxiety had become so overwhelming. It was almost like, you know, when it's almost like every possible thing you're looking at is a trigger. Mm-hmm. Every possible like movement I make is a trigger. So many triggers were happening that I broke down. It was a really difficult time that, and a difficult time, of course, for my partner as well. Seeing where that gets to, there was a day when I punched the wall and my knuckles just bleeding. I was very distraught, and you just feel like you're losing control. And I mean, my self-hatred was really high at that point. I remember one day standing in front of the mirror and just, I wrote down every single thing from head to toe what I hated about myself. Oh. And I would cry myself to sleep. I couldn't even, and it would take ages. It just take ages to do anything at that time. You know, it'd take ages just to get dressed. Getting dressed can take half an hour, 45 minutes, just because the simple act of standing up, because that might give me some sort of sensation, would trigger off so much anxiety that I'd have to sit down and stand up again, and that would take a lot of time. But I found a little bit of help really with this. There was this my friend Laura Darrell set up this company called hashtag It Affects Me, when people used to put those post-its on their heads. I'm not sure if you saw it.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Yeah. And she's an actor as well, and she because she knows one of my friends, managed to get to meet her, and we talked. She very kindly gave up her time, and we just spent an afternoon one day talking through some issues, and she asked me to write a blog for them, which I did, and it was one of the most cathartic experiences I've ever had. But it also, I couldn't believe the amount of people that wrote back saying they had similar things, or and that was the birth there of some sort of like I guess like advocacy and wanting to talk about it more, make it more of a conversation that people don't need to feel so much shame for, because I think that's the big poison. Sorry, I think for me is shame, and so I'm very thankful to her for doing that. And she has then since then introduced me to efficacy, which is the CBT therapy, which I now do. I'm coming towards the end of it. I've got two more sessions, so after about 10 months now, and they have been fantastic. I tried so many, obviously, counselors and everyone's up until efficacy, but that when I first went there, I guess I was going there kind of thinking this isn't going to help again. I've recovered before. And always ended up back where I am. I remember having a conversation with my mum in the summer, just as I started it. And I just said, you know, I think it's a matter of life or death. And that's not making it heavy at all. That really was. Because it got to a point where you're just thinking, I'm not living here anymore. So I would rather kill myself because... Mm. I just cannot face even going out the front door anymore. I've said no to all my dreams and aspirations. I've been so reclusive. I haven't, you know, all my friendships, my contacts, my, you know, the groups that inspire me, that's all gone. The life's gone very, very small. And I'm just existing here. So I knew it was a real life, or death kind of thing, and I did that OCI, you know, the OC index.
Okay, yeah.
That test with efficacy at the start, and I think they said if you score a 40, I think it was, that's correct me if I'm wrong. Actually, that's supposed to be a significant. Yeah, you have significant OCD. Mm. Or something. I know I'd scored over 80, so I was very. Yeah. Severe at the time. I just think, oh my god, I don't know how I managed to even get to the counselor's door, you know. But she has been amazing, the therapist. Her name's Shireen, and this has been the first time I've ever done exposure response prevention, and that has just been an absolute game changer for me. It's the hardest thing I've ever done. It's not easy, but it's the results are quite amazing, and it's really enabled me to start getting my life back. It's tough, but it takes a lot of courage, I think, to do it. But you know, we built a hierarchy of fears, which. And you know, we sort of just done gradual exposure to those as we've gone up. I think to throw me in at the deep end with exposure number 10, I probably would have panicked and quit the therapy. But starting small, for me, a lot of it would go about relationships. So watching a rom-com or something, watching, you know, some of these films that inspire this sort of Hollywood idea of what love is. And they lived happily ever after, etc. You know, things that can trigger that, I probably started with. And then it would come to things like, you know, just actively smile at that woman that you pass on the street. It doesn't mean anything. You don't have to beat yourself up. You don't have to analyze it. I mean, the rumination, I mean, that is one of the things that the replaying events, when I found out that was a really, really bad thing to do. And it's so addictive because I came so good at doing it because I built those neural pathways to, you know, fire, you know, instantly. I guess it's essentially challenging what you almost, you've become so good at doing subconsciously, and your instincts, and a lot of it goes against your instincts.
Yeah.
And that's really interesting as well, because I think being an actor, I always got told to follow my instincts, and OCD says don't follow those instincts. So it's that's kind of yeah, that's quite interesting. I'm trying to think. I haven't seen explained clearly here where I first realized I had OCD. Sorry, in about 8 years ago, but I've had it for nearly 20 years.
Hmm.
So it's a bit mad that it's taken that long.
Yeah.
To realize that.
And get the right treatment.
Yeah. So it took 12 years to realize I had OCD, and then it's taken 7 years after that to get the right treatment. So
yeah, 19 years. Yeah.
It's, takes a big part of your life. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Well, I got a few questions if you don't mind me jumping in. Firstly, thank you for going into so much detail and being so open. I appreciate it. Cool, man. First question really was, do your family know, and if so, kind of when did they sort of find out?
Like I explained earlier, so my mum she's known since I was 13 that there's been something there, and she's followed me through it. She's been probably the closest person in terms of always being so available to listen, which I'm very thankful for. And then I think my dad's got on board with it a bit later. He's been amazing, and he's just a very logical person. So and also I think when you're younger, trying to speak to your dad about vulnerable stuff, things that are going through your mind, it's not really a comfortable subject. So I think it's taken longer with my dad to just to try and explain it. But now he's become almost an expert himself. He'll sometimes speak to, like, phone me up and say, I had this thought about this, and I realized that's what you must think with. And I was like, oh yeah. So he's got really into it now, which is great. Mm-hmm. And then my brother and sister have only really, I think, found out very recently. I think as I've become got it so much more under control, and not feeling any more ashamed of saying, you know, talking openly about it. So I think I've been very open with them. They're very supportive, like the most supportive. That's one of the things as well. I think I've been so lucky to have such a supportive family.
Mm.
Live in such a, I brought up in, you couldn't be brought up in a nicer place than Robina, and all the Robinaites love that, in Cardiff. And my life was like full of opportunity and full of, like, you know, so that's another, you know, my lifestyle has been very comfortable as a child. But then it just took this one thought to pop in my head, and it blew up. I think that's another thing that you do I used to beat myself up about, was that idea of, look, there's people in third world countries, there's people, you know, who have real problems. Your problem's not real. It's just in your head, sort yourself out. You know, you're a disgrace. You know, that's the kind of.
Yeah.
It's a
tough one.
Yeah, but you know, no, they've been wonderful, really
good.
Wonderful.
Good. Yeah. No, thanks for that, and I appreciate you sharing that last bit. I think many people, including myself, can sometimes feel almost guilty about even being in therapy and being like, people have it way worse than me. What am I sort of complaining about? That was definitely my experience. It took a long time to be able to feel worthy. You know, that regardless of how much I suffered or didn't, if I suffered a bit, that deserves treatment, love, compassion, all that good stuff. So you mentioned about the blog post, and you said it was very cathartic, kind of writing it out. And you said about it potentially got rid of some shame. What was it about writing out your experience that kind of removed some of that shame?
I've always had to write it down. I've gone through so many notebooks, so many. I always carry one with me everywhere I go and write down, because it's too much of a jumble up in my head and it's too confused with emotion and all the rest of it. So I think, first of all, it's very objective. I write it down on the paper and I can see it, and it's like, oh, I can see where this fits now, and where, you know, see the patterns, and it makes more sense to me. I think I had to get it off my chest at that time. I don't know at the time if it was maybe a little bit of a cry for help, but I wanted to, and it's something that I'm really, really feel like I'm passionate about, is helping other people. I realize that's my whole mantra, if you like, with acting. The whole reason I fell into acting, I actually decided I wanted to be an actor during my first bout of OCD, you know, because I realized watching other people going through something, trying to figure something out, showing that you're not alone, that other people feel the same and go through similar experiences, is a really collective experience, to share something, just to take the armor off and say, you know, I have these intrusive thoughts, and I do too. I feel I hate my body, whatever it might be, and just sharing that and helping others is something that I that was the really cathartic thing, is that it engaged with other people who relate, and they related with it, and they came back with theirs. And it just, I just didn't feel alone for the first, I felt so, so alone when I wrote that. I was living on my own in London, and it was the first time I'd gone through depression as well. And I've never experienced depression apart, like, obviously I've experienced a lot of low mood and, you know, with that would come from OCD and anxiety, but it was the first time I'd experienced real depression. And it, all I can say is that it felt like this dark, inky, it was almost very physical. I could almost see this very dark, inky blackness coming over me. And that was very difficult to lift myself out of that. That would have been around the time, like I explained to you, I was looking in the mirror and listing all the things I hate about myself. So knowing that there was somebody else out there, even if only one person got back to me and said that, I would have made such a difference. Because I think for me, it's been shame and loneliness are like the two of the worst ingredients for that you can have, that allow all this negativity to fester.
No, thank you for describing it in so much detail. What's the word? Visually, like, really sort of made me see it. Thanks for that. I'm always intrigued when I hear people say, you know, something was cathartic. So thank you for explaining. Yeah. So with efficacy and the CBT you've done with them, and then the ERP, when you first sat down and the therapist kind of started talking about ERP and how you guys were going to do it together, I guess, what was coming up for you? What was it like? Were you fearful? Were you ready? Were you, you know, anything?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I was definitely fearful, especially when initially, obviously, once you first mentioned ERP, the first thing I do is go and Google ERP, you know, so you find out all these horror stories. And I was like, no, sorry, stay off that. So I didn't go down that route. But it is, I definitely felt fear because it was the first time I was being told I've got to face my fears. And it's going to take an incredible amount of courage to face these fears and sit with it. So some of those things might have been looking at a picture of someone or an image of something that might really, really set me off. And I might have to, I'd usually perform a compulsion before I knew it and I got rid of it or chucked it away. But I had to look at it for, I think there it was an hour towards the end. It was like, can you sit and look at this picture for an hour? And noticing that anxiety spike, but you know, hitting that top of the curve, and then it eventually starts to fade and fade and fade, and then the next day you do it and it spikes, but it doesn't spike as high, and it the curve some days it might go higher, but I think the fact that I kept seeing that I was able to sit with the anxiety, it was a horrible feeling, but that's all it is, it's a horrible feeling. Feelings aren't important. And I think that's been something that's really helped me, is knowing that at the end of your feelings is nothing, but at the end of your principle, at the end of every principle is a promise. That's what I that's a quote of Ed Thomas, I think.
Eric Thomas, yeah.
E.T.
E.T., yeah.
I've listened to a lot of his stuff, and it really, that really helps that line, actually, So what else did you say there on that question?
No, it was just really it was really good. But your first experiences of kind of being in, when the therapist was discussing ERP with you and maybe developing the hierarchy.
Yeah, and developing that hierarchy was just really helpful. Again, just to work it, to see something written down. It's almost like, I can see this mountain now that I'm going to climb.
Yeah.
I'm going to start at the bottom. I'm not going to think, it's like going out for a run. I love running. I got addicted to running. That really helped me get through this. You know, if you think at the start of the run, oh my God, I'm going to do 10K, 10K is bloody miles, you know, whatever, you know, I'm not going to get, you start thinking about the bigger thing, you're not going to get there. But if you think, I'm just gonna think about one step at a time, and I'm just gonna enjoy this one step, one step, one step. And eventually you've done 5K and you're like, oh, I'm feeling good. I've got my endorphin rush coming now as well. I can go do a bit more. I think working that through was great. She was brilliant as well, because it was the first therapy where she was actively using like the whiteboard, and we were writing things down, and she'd get me to write things down. It's been very practical based. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, much more sort of engaging or hands-on. That's great. And what were your... So when you did the hierarchy and you sort of listed it out, and you sort of ranked it in terms of how scary it is or how anxiety-provoking, when you first did that and you saw whatever your, like, 10 out of 10 was, was there part of you... Well, I guess what were your thoughts of that 10 out of 10 at that point, like the idea of facing that thing at that time?
At that time, the idea of facing that sort of, as you said, that 10 out of 10 was frightening. There's no two ways about that. I think, simply speaking from my own experiences, it is frightening to face it. But I was also really, really determined to beat this. And I know I've tried everything else and nothing else has worked. So, and this was so different doing this that I just, and like I said, I got to a point. Unfortunately, I think it is for a lot of people that I seem to, and people that I've heard on your podcast as well, you know, when they say it's only when they seem to get to, like, I was thinking of killing myself, that I actually felt determined enough to beat this. And that's crazy. That shouldn't be the case. But that's the case it had got to. So I was just so determined to, like I said to my mum in the summer, you know, I need to save my life. So I did see it as that. And I've really stuck to it. Anything that I find that's, I might be avoiding this now because of my fear, I just go and do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost become a new addiction. And that event that at first is quite hard work because you're going against your intuition, but eventually it does become second nature.
Yeah, almost leaning into it now, as and when it rises.
Yeah, absolutely, and really engaging in the present moment. That's been something that I've really refocusing on that. And I think actually this time now with coronavirus and not knowing that the future is so uncertain, being able to just come straight back to the present moment at the moment has really been helping actually with what's going on now as well. Not getting sort of overwhelmed by, you know, I think our relationship with time is such a key thing as well with anxiety.
Yeah, good point. Just taking one day at a time.
Yeah, it's my favorite. One of my favorite quotes, that William Blake's, to see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. I just love those four lines. They just make me feel so peaceful. And the other day, all I did was sit in the garden for about 2 hours, like in the middle of the garden, just watch, like, oh, there's a bumblebee, you know, there's a bird. And it was so relaxing, very meditative. And that really helps that for me, focusing on the present like that.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing. And would you say that the therapy you've done recently has helped you kind of get to that place?
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, there's... I think maybe when I was about 6-7 sessions in, I had a feeling that was like, I wonder if this is going to be it and it's too good to be true. But I've had quite a lot. I've had nearly 20 sessions now. There's been so much to unpack. But it's just been life changing, really. And every single session I've had I've had a kind of wow moment. Not to say that's what you should have, because it's different for everyone, but there's maybe if not a wow moment, there's always a moment where I was like, God, that is so interesting. That really changes the way I think about this or that.
Thank you. Well, that kind of leads into my next question, which is kind of, what was a sort of a big epiphany moment for you in your recovery? Or like in the way you've just described, kind of a light bulb moment, just any ones that stick out for you of, okay, I get it now, or, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I would say something that is, I might have said it already, but I think certainly to light bulb kind of moments for me have been those moments when I've realized I need to go against my intuition here. And I'm trying to think of a key example for you. But it's almost like when, like I said, when I'm going running, for example, I noticed during the therapy when I've been running, I was thinking, oh my God, every single part of my intuition here is telling me to stop running. I'm in so much pain. I can barely breathe, this is really boring, you know, and all these negative thoughts and feelings were telling me to stop. But it's being able to override that and just be like, no, I am going to keep running. I'm going to keep running. Throw as many negative thoughts as you want at me. Throw as many, horrible feelings and sensations. I'm going to get to the end of this. I'm going to get to the finish line. I'm going to feel great because of it. And in fact, I might get to the finish line and think, no, I'm going to run all the way back now as well. And realizing that action is taking positive action can override all these thoughts and feelings that I place so much importance on. So I think somewhere between the running and the therapy, I kind of realized that, I call it actions, not over feelings. That is what I call it for me. Cause I've always been a feelings first, then take action. And now I'm like, no, just turn that light off if you want to turn it off. You don't have to have a what I would call a positive, pure thought as I turn the light bulb off. That doesn't make any sense. Just turn it off. And whatever thought and feeling happens, it's irrelevant. It doesn't mean anything.
Hmm.
And I think that's a big thing, that realizing that, yeah, thoughts and feelings don't mean anything. It's what action you decide to take, how you choose to behave. You know, we all have. I think that was very interesting. It was my very first session. She gave Shireen gave me this list of a survey of people who'd had intrusive thoughts, what kind of intrusive thoughts, how frequent, and if somebody looked at that from the outside, they might think it was crazy, but it just showed me that everyone has these. The intrusive mm-hmm. thoughts aren't the problem. It's how I'm reacting to them. It's how much importance I'm giving them. They're not important. What I decide to do is important. And that's been huge. I think that's been difficult with being as well, having this sort of dramatic background in acting, in that you are taught to follow your feelings. You're taught to really focus on your feelings a lot, and emotion. But doesn't work for me in real real life. Sensitivity to it.
Yeah, no, I like that. Thank you for sharing. And a similar question then, but kind of the flip side, which is, what was a sort of a big roadblock for you in your recovery journey, and how did you overcome it?
A big roadblock. Big roadblock. I think a huge roadblock for me was when I had the little period where I felt like, after going to this counsellor in the NHS, I felt like I'd beaten the OCD. And for about a year, I was okay. And I thought, I've made some real headway. Things are only going to get better now. They're not going to get worse. And I don't even know how it started. It was just very like osmosis kind of effect. Eventually, out of nowhere, I realized I was back at square number one. Well, actually, it felt like I was at square like minus 10. And that was really, really disheartening. At the time, when you feel like you've recovered and you suddenly find yourself, I'm struggling with the same issues again. And I'm never going to be better. That's what it felt like. Again, I'm saying like feelings aren't important, because that's just what it felt like. But it's just not the case. And I would say to anyone who may struggle with that, or may have felt like they've recovered but they've relapsed or whatever, you can always get better again. I think someone said something like, in the end, it'll all be okay.
Hmm.
And if it's not okay, it's not the end.
Yeah.
And I really like that. It'll always be fine. It's like, I think I've become very content with feeling like, just in life in general, but also like, I'll go out today, I'll leave the house, and I know some things are bad are going to happen. But it'll all be okay. I know it can sound quite cliche, a bit cheesy, but it really is the case. Like, you go for a run, I think, I know I'm going to feel a lot of pain. I know it's going to be a struggle. I know I'm going to have a lot of negativity, but I'm going to do it anyway. And then that became the thing with ERP then, was like, this is going to be a horrible experience, is what it felt like before I started. This might be a horrible experience. I might feel scared and frightened. I might feel my anxiety rising, you know, all these horrible physical sensations, but I'm going to commit to this hour, and there's no way I'm going to perform a compulsion. No way. And that suddenly makes you start to feel really strong. Yeah. I've said to myself, I'm not going to do that. And I didn't. And So that helped. That then becomes oddly quite addictive then. what other stuff can you throw at me?
Almost turned it into kind of a game then.
Yeah, very much so.
No, thanks for sharing that. And you know, words of hope for anyone experiencing OCD.
I would say it will all be okay in the end. And I think I know I've been to many places myself, and so many other people out there have, of like really at the bottom, of feeling like I just would rather just end it because I can't see any other way. But just taking positive action. So not thinking necessarily positively. It's very difficult to think positively when you're thinking negatively already. Mm. Very difficult to do that, but just to do something positive instead. So celebrate all those achievements that you make. Like one day I felt so depressed, felt like I, you know, felt terrible, but I managed to get up. I made my bed. I got dressed. And I think I watched TV, and I celebrated that. And, you know, I really celebrated little achievements like that. It took me so much willpower just to get out of bed some days. And you should celebrate those little achievements, because when you start doing that as well, they start to build up as well. It starts, like you said, like a positive game. I hope that can help in some way. I think and being your own best friend. You know, we're taught to feel shame. We're taught to constantly look at our negative stuff right from the start of primary school. We're taught, you know, don't be naughty, don't say a rude word, don't do this. And we're constantly sort of, I think, taught to almost scrutinize ourselves so much instead of actually being our own best friend. And I think you've got to talk to yourself how you would talk to a loved one. You know, like some of the things I said to myself when I was really struggling, I can't believe that's what a bully would say. You know, that's really, really vindictive. Don't say that to yourself. Yeah. So be your own best friend and celebrate every little achievement, no matter how insignificant. And I think, and just take your time, be patient with it. Mm. Really be patient. Don't start worrying so much about the future. You've got to focus on the present. And that's hard to do. That is hard to focus on the present. We're not taught to do that either. We're taught, oh, when I go to high school, I get this grade, then I go here, I go here. Until you've got a degree, and then you kind of go, oh, that's what to do now. So I think that as well, yeah, committing to the present, being kind to yourself, yeah.
Yeah, no, thank you. I love all of that. Be kind to yourself. Okay, so you can pick up the phone and call the 20-year-old Sam. What would you tell him?
The 20-year-old Sam. I would first of all tell him to be himself and stop trying to be James Dean or someone. Just really embrace the Samness of Sam as a I think being happy with being yourself, certainly at 20, is very important. I think when you are being yourself and you are being true to yourself anyway, I feel like so many other things become irrelevant that I was worrying about because I desperately wanted to fit in or whatever it is. And I would say really, really, if there's something that you love doing, then really, really stick with it. Like, even if you get told, you know, like I said, that many times with the acting, I've thought, I just don't want to do this. I try to find reasons not to do it because it's been difficult at times, or, you know, particularly stressful at times. But if you love doing it, you've got to keep doing it, because that's been another thing that's really got me through this period now, is that focusing on the present. It's almost like I say to myself every day, focus on the present. That means fighting the OCD bully, which is, if you like, that bully in the playground who says, give me 10p. But if I give him 10p, which is a compulsion, tomorrow, what's he going to do? He's going to ask for 20p. Yeah. So it, don't give him 5p either, because that's still still slightly slightly doing a compulsion there. So you don't give him anything. He might hit me in the face for doing that, but it's going to hurt. It's going to be tough, but he isn't going to come back tomorrow. Mm. And I think that's been really, really a helpful visual thing for me, is fight the OCD bully and keep doing what you love doing, because it's something I can really focus on.
Yeah.
I can focus on the present on that. If someone puts a play in front of me, I'm going to read it and enjoy it, and I can commit to the present with it. So I'd say, yeah, really stick with what you love doing, and don't, you know, you've been given these talents or whatever it is. You've, you know, everyone's got it. Everyone's got this something to shine. We're all meant to do that, but we all get a bit scared of wanting to show off our talent. I think everyone is. So everyone's got it, but everyone gets told, don't get too big for your boots. But if you do it, then everyone else feels encouraged to do it. So it's a good, so I would say keep following your, and I also change that. I can't say keep following your dream, because I realized when I was saying dream, I was so focused on just one thing, and that still might be out of my control, one, you know? So I changed it to follow my heart. Mm. Whatever my heart tells me, like, this is what I love to do, then I'll do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever. No, thank you. Good distinction. and then you've got a billboard in Cardiff. What do you want written on that billboard?
What's occurring? What do I have on that? I think what I actually have already said, but it would be to be your own best friend and celebrate every achievement, no matter how insignificant it may seem. Yeah,
I like that. Yeah. And then lastly, is there anything else that you wish you could have said today?
Probably so much. there's helpful texts. I've got them with me. These are this one, which you'll know.
Do you want to read them out? Yeah.
Overcoming Obsessive Compulsive Disorder, David Veal and Rob Wilson. That I got told to get this out when I started. My therapist told me to get this out as something to look at as well, like side by side. And this book, for me, for anyone with pure OCD, the Rose Protection Pure, that, I mean, she does not hold back in talking about the truth of it all. And it's funny as well. And it's not just like a depressing read. It's a memoir, and it's actually really well written. So that's been great. And also anyone, I think, who feels maybe I felt a lot of shame about, I take medication as well. Take fluoxetine now, and that has been a real change. It's made a big difference to me. So I think if anyone's feeling a bit nervous or maybe even shameful for taking or relying on medication, and there's no reason to. And you know, it's no different to someone with diabetes taking insulin. It's just no different. So I'd like to get that out there. That's really worked well, coinciding with the ERP as well,
I think. Important. Thank you for sharing that and being open. And look, thank you so much just generally for this whole last hour, sharing your story, going into so much detail. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. And it's been a real privilege getting to speak to you, Stuart. And, you know, if I've waffled anywhere, I apologize. But
it's all good.
I'm new to all this Skyping stuff. I'm such a technophobe. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
So there you have it. Thank you to Sam for his time and to you guys for listening. And don't forget, today's episode is sponsored by NoCD. To find out more about NoCD and their treatment plans, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories, or the link will be in the description of this episode. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. Until we speak, take care.